All right, committee members, do you have questions for Mr. Long? And also, remember, we have a lot of people in this room who drove down here many hours and took the day off from work to be heard, so don't monopolize all the time, okay? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for coming. I see that New Hampshire's going to get an economic boost from this. How much power will we actually get from the Northern Pass Broadband?
Well, it's under negotiation, so it hasn't been finalized. But if I want to give you a comparison, New Hampshire is less than 7% of New England market. And New England is a market. It's regulated by the federal government. New England is a market. So you have to think of New England as a whole. When the D.C. line that exists in New Hampshire today, which does not stop in New Hampshire, goes to Massachusetts, when that line was built, New Hampshire was given a 10% entitlement, which was more than its pro rata share. You know, so I would hope for something more than that.
Again, just a reminder, the legislature is, even if you don't agree with somebody, you don't make comments, right? And so no noises or yays or boos or ad jams, all right? And legislators, also a reminder, we don't debate witnesses. So, Representative Kelly,
I just have a point. This will not be the only session that we as legislators will have on this, correct?
Correct.
I just wanted to
this is a multi-year
reiterate
thing.
That
multi-year project.
We will be going over this and over this.
Representative Rep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Long.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what the cost is of an underground transmission line and why you decided against it?
It's really design specific. The rule of thumb is 10 to 1. Underground, particularly transmission lines, are very expensive underground because they're high voltage. And because you have to have transition points between underground and overhead, which means another substation, and substations are extremely expensive. Plus, as I remind people, we live in a granite state, and you're probably going to be blasting out granite. You'll be cutting down trees. You'll be making trenches. So you're going to have a line there that's been dug up and made. But it's extremely expensive, and it would make the project uneconomic.
Representative Remick?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. I worked with you on the co-op loop. I guess my question, well, I have several questions. One, how would this affect the co-op loop transmission line?
It would not affect the co-op loop at all, and I think that's a continuing issue to be addressed. It's a DC line that brings us power into Franklin and then distributes it through New England. So it really, DC line is not something you can just tap into along the way. So it's not going to do anything for the COAS loop unless we were to build some AC line at the same time, which I think is unlikely. And then you can get some synergies of construction. You can save some money. Mm-hmm. But given that there's been no decisions made on the COAS loop, it really won't have any impact. That will be a separate matter, either to be resolved or not, you know, as we go forward.
Yeah, I know in the northern part of the state, there is a natural gas transmission line that was buried, so it is possible to do. And I have been told by relatives that live in Connecticut that some of the transmission lines there have been buried. Now, would you be willing to try to negotiate a burial of transmission lines in some of the scenic areas so it won't ruin the view for a lot of our economic, tourism, basically?
Yeah, I think it would just be cost prohibitive, to be direct with you. You know, natural gas lines, that's where they go. They go underground. I think it would be a huge safety issue to have natural gas lines above ground. And that's where they go. And the federal government decides on the route and the approval for natural gas. They don't. But the lines in Connecticut, and they were 345. They were not high voltage DC. But the 345 kV AC lines, there were portions of those lines that were put underground, and they were extremely expensive. And because the rest of New England did not need them to be underground, the state of Connecticut paid for the excess cost of that. So the consumers of Connecticut are paying for that. Whereas on this project, consumers are not paying anything. I mean, if you said, we'll pay more to have it underground, that'd be a different story. But these costs are paid entirely by Quebec. And they're paying the cost of the generation plus the cost of transmission, you know, plus they're going to compete in the market. And there's no new renewable in New England that will do that, that can do that. They need a subsidy. So I think they're, you can't just keep adding costs and expect it to be economic. It wouldn't be economic.
Representative Levasseur.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
How far away are you in terms of time? What's the timeline for starting construction? And will you start from Franklin and go north or Canada?
And everybody please speak up. We can't. Many of us can't hear you.
Okay, the construction, I mean, there are engineering studies going in right now, but the actual physical construction where you're able to hire a lot more people, that doesn't begin until after you have approvals. And so that won't happen until after the State Site Evaluation Committee makes a decision. And the filing, and that takes about a year, and the filing really won't happen until sometime next year. But the whole schedule is driven by what the Department of Energy does, and then how long that takes. So general rule of thumb, I've been saying it takes about 2 years for approvals and about 3 years for construction. But that could vary.
Other questions from representatives?
Just one question.
Please,
Mr. Garrett. Where is the jurisdiction of the federal and the state end off? I know you said we have site review. If the state does not approve the site, then is the project scrubbed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the role, the federal government has a lot of different departments involved. They have the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which has jurisdiction over transmission and prices and terms of service on transmission. And they've already approved the project and concept, and there's the business terms, in other words, the payments between Hydro-Québec and the owners of the line. That's before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and that's expected to be acted on within the next 30, 60 days. The siting process is probably the one that's most interesting to people in this room, is the Department of Energy and then the State Site Evaluation Committee. And then a power purchase agreement between Public Service Company and Hydro-Québec, that would be subject to the jurisdiction of the state's New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission. They would have to approve that. The presidential permit is what the Department of Energy is addressing. It's something that the president has to ultimately approve for the importation of power across the border, you know, from Canada to the United States. And the DOE, they do the same thing with highways and other energy projects around the country. They do an extensive environmental impact study, and it's all under their control. They decide what needs to be studied, and they will ultimately decide what they think the right route is. And then that will be done in the later period of their work in conjunction with the state, and then ultimately it has to come before the state.
Mr. Wong, could you briefly talk about, we've heard a lot of talk about eminent domain takings and rights of way and ruining people's land values while this project's going on or is pending. Talk about, are you going to take people's property? What's up with that?
You kind of started with the hard one, didn't you? You know, the objective is to avoid all that. Yes, utilities have the right to take property if it's in the public interest, just like highways, I mean, transmission lines. It's existed for decades. It's seldom used. It's not something utility wants to do. What we want to do is work with people on a route that they can find acceptable, to find mitigating factors that might make the project more acceptable, a construction technique that might make it more acceptable. You know, if all that fails, then, you know, eminent domain is the last resort type of tool that you have. But that's only after the state found it in the public interest to go forward.
Representative Introne and Representative Kane.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, we've started to touch on most of the questions that I had, which was the routing. But perhaps you can address the route that's out there now. Why is it there? How did you get involved? What is that situation?
Well, somebody has to start somewhere. And the project proponent is required by DOE to propose a route and alternatives to the route, a primary route and some secondary routes. And that's what happened. That's what went to the Department of Energy. And I think most everyone in this room has probably seen the maps. Now the Department of Energy says, well, I could reject it all, or I could pick another one altogether, or, you know, they will now take public input and suggestions and concerns, and then ultimately they will say what they think the best route is. So it's a process that the applicant doesn't control. DOE controls it.
Yes. So does that mean, I guess, we'll have public hearings with your involvement in DOE all over the route, the proposed route?
I think the way the process works is the project applicants don't really have a voice. I mean, these public hearings are to hear from other people, not the applicant. They already heard from the applicant because the applicant put in the application. So it's their process for seeking other input. And then the DOE would direct the applicant to do some more studies if they thought more would be done. So the way some people have described it is the applicant now works for the DOE. The DOE, at the applicant's cost, says go do these studies. But they're in control. They're in control of the process.
For the follow-up?
Thank you. No, thank you.
Okay. Representative Kane?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Long, from your prior statement, I understand then we could conclude that 90% of the power would go elsewhere in New England. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, I don't know if it's 90% or what the percent is, but we would, you know, try to fit it into our own portfolio and put it into a way that, you know, would fit with our customers' need. And, you know, it's pretty obvious PSNH doesn't need 1,200 megawatts. 1,200 megawatts is, I mean, the Seabrook power is not used in New Hampshire. That goes elsewhere. There's the three largest plants in New Hampshire, two are gas, one Seabrook. All that power is not used for New Hampshire. It goes somewhere else. So this power is renewable. It will go into the New England market, but New Hampshire will get a portion of it that fits our needs and that is economic for us. So there will definitely be financial value for us, for our customers.
Yes, I'm curious about your definition of renewable. I think there's some question about whether we in New Hampshire would characterize flooding acres and acres of land as renewable. You assume that, I gather, by the use of the term, I'm not sure that is shared.
There's no doubt in my mind that hydroelectric power is renewable. It's recognized worldwide as being renewable. It is a replenishable and renewable fuel source, and the fuel source is water, just like our own hydro plants. Which are runner river plants that run with the river. I think everybody would recognize those as renewable. So sometimes people get confused between renewable and RPS qualified renewable. States have set up policies, New Hampshire being one of them, for a renewable portfolio standard, and it has objectives. And one of its objectives is to create new renewable in New Hampshire, in New England, because it applies to all of New England. And so that renewable portfolio standard doesn't include all renewable. For instance, it doesn't include PSNH's hydro plants. It doesn't include other hydro plants in New Hampshire, and it doesn't include plants in Quebec, in Hydro-Quebec. None of those are qualified under the state's renewable portfolio standard. So we can't use them to meet this 25% requirement. We can't use them to meet them. So PSNH might end up with 40% renewable, but maybe only 25% of our power qualifies under the state renewable portfolio standard. So that's where the confusion comes, and that's probably why a lot of people said, well, House Bill 302 changes that. Well, you know, you've heard what people said about that. But it is renewable. Should it? But what is the state's policy? And the state's policy is to create subsidies for in-state renewable. Okay, and Hydro-Quebec is not asking for a subsidy.
Representative Pastore, then Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've stated that you are open to public input and everybody's ideas in looking at alternate routes to the route that you have developed so far. Now, my question is, in the process of developing the route that you have proposed, did you seek that public input? What kind of public participation was there in the process of drawing that proposed?
There was discussions with different parties, but there wasn't a public forum per se, because we knew that forum would come later, and there would be processes for addressing that, and you know, the people might disagree with the route. For instance, the folks who designed this, the engineers and others who worked on this, they picked a route that one would use existing rights of way. You know, assuming and hearing from people that using an existing right-of-way was better than a new right-of-way. So that was one of the criteria they used. Another criteria they used was try to avoid what's called protected lands, okay, to try to route around protected lands. You know, so that's open for discussion. If somebody else thinks that, no, you shouldn't avoid protected lands, that's the least environmental impact, well, that's the kind of things the Department of Energy would like to hear. So we knew, or the folks who put this together knew, that when they put it together, it wasn't final. I mean, it's not final until a government official says it's final, and they can change it.
Quick follow-up.
Hello. I am, the issue is not with the existing right-of-ways. The issue is with what I understand is roughly 40 miles of transmission line that does not go through existing right-of-ways, and it's about those 40 miles that I'm thinking about.
Yes.
Was there public input and consultation in the process of determining where those 40 miles were going to go?
Yeah, but the same answer. You know, yes, people were consulted, and that's why, you know, why the, some of the things we heard was try to avoid protected lands. So we try to avoid protected lands. But no, we did not have a public session. No, that's the process now, is to seek that. Our, you know, remember, the obligation was to submit a proposal, and then the proposal gets scrutinized. And that's where we are right now.
I'm going to agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you address for a minute the issue of the need for the power? The company is now going, asking for a 20-year extension of the license of the Seabrook plant. Merrimack Station is now in the process of a $300-plus million project to extend the life of that, the coal plant. Could you address the issue of the need for power?
Yes, thank you. Public service company has generation, I think, as most of you know, and that makes up our portfolio. We also have some power contracts. We have one with Leinster. It's a wind project, which lasts for 15 years. And we also have a contract before the Public Utilities Commission to buy some power from a to-be-built biomass facility in the Berlin-Gorham area, because we think that will have a huge economic impact up there. So you take those sources plus our own sources, and we're still buying power in the market. We don't have enough to meet all of our needs. We're still buying power in the market. And so for us, you know, we can come up with designs that will supplement our portfolio. So that's from a PS&H perspective. But then, as I mentioned earlier, New England is one market. New England is one market. It's controlled by it's called an independent system operator, New England, and it's made up of hundreds of power plants. New England has more power than it needs. Of course, as I tell people, electricity, whenever you have less power than you need, we have blackouts. So you always have more power than you need because you need to provide for contingencies. And so, but the problem in New England is that most of its power is fossil plant. Most of it, the dominant fuel source is natural gas. The next highest use power in New England is nuclear. And then a coal, which is only 15%, and you got some oil and some hydro. So New England has more, but it's not renewable. So New England doesn't have enough renewable resources to meet its own requirements and objectives. So that's the dilemma. It's a dilemma across the United States. How do you have more renewable, you know, and less fossil? And the recession had a lot to do with this. The recession has really created a little more supply because of lower demands. But it's, if we ever do recover, it'll go the other way.
Clarify, PS&H does not own Seabrook.
Thank you. Yes, yes. There's still the misnomer that PS&H owns no part of Seabrook. We get no power from Seabrook. Our customers get none of the power from Seabrook. We have no business relationship. Seabrook is owned by Florida Power and Light, which recently changed their name. I think it's NextEra, and they put that power out to market. We don't have any business relationship with them other than we're connected to them. Our transmission system's connected to them. So. That power all goes to the rest of New England.